If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Congresswoman Ann Wagner has represented Missouri's 2nd Congressional District since 2013. And now she's seeking re-election in a district that's been changed pretty dramatically by redistricting. The Baldwin Republican joins us on Politically Speaking to break down the big issues in her clash with Democrat Trish Gunby and previews how a Republican majority could govern the U.S. House. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We have to talk about things that matter to people.
I've tried to bring that same aggressive, iconoclast style with me to the United States Senate.
I think my district is a model for the state.
We put Missourians first.
You just kind of have to find the common ground with people.
I believe that this district deserves someone who represents their values.
After I came back to St. Louis, I started thinking that I could have a bigger role on the change that I wanted to make.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. I'm flying solo today, and I'm in the studio with one of the people who is trying to represent Jason Rosenbaum in Washington.
Ann Wagner, I'm glad to be with you. It's a pleasure. I've been doing these with you, Politically Speaking, now for years and years and years. It's great.
You've come in every election cycle since 2016, and we do appreciate that. We did have your opponent, Trish Gunby, on earlier, and I think it's important for voters to understand where these candidates stand on issues. So why did you decide to run for re-election? I know that your name had been thrown around as running for the U.S. Senate along with every other Republican in the state, but you're firmly going toward the House, and you seem pretty happy about that.
I am. I belong in the House. It's where the work gets done. It's where the heavy lifting happens. It's where we actually churn through legislation. And I'm running for re-election to be that conservative voice in Congress that will work for you and your families and fight for, I believe, our Midwestern values that are being dramatically threatened by this administration. It is really about I think at the end of the day, our very way of life, which is under assault. I can go through the litany here, and it's a 40-year high inflation that is affecting everyone. It's a hidden tax that really means that people are not making two ends meet. One out of six Americans are in arrears in their utility bills, in their home energy bills. I mean, I went to the grocery store to buy Halloween candy yesterday, and the price of Skittles is up 41%, Twix 53%. I mean, I've seen the numbers. It's gas is out of control. We've got crime that is out of control, certainly in our city of St. Louis and across the country. And I believe that's because of the policies that this administration supports, whether it's open borders. I think we're somewhere, Jason, around 4.5 million illegal migrants across the southern border in the last 21 months that Joe Biden has been president. And what that means is fentanyl that has come across. We have some 70,000 Americans now that are dead from fentanyl overdoses, 100,000 because of opioid abuse. This is an assault by China, by the cartels, against the American people, and I see nothing by this administration or the Democrats to do something about it. So whether it's energy independence, whether it's foreign policy issues, I could get into a whole host of how provocative things are and boiling over, whether it's Iran, China and Taiwan, Ukraine and Russia. I'm telling you, I am running because we have got to get a hold of the reins. Enough is enough, and begin to stop some of this madness that has really spiraled our country into, I think, a very dangerous place.
We'll get to the individual issues later on in the show, but your new district, as I alluded to, includes a lot of new territory. It includes part of Richmond Heights and Maplewood, and I'm sure the Democrats there are thrilled that you're their congresswoman. But it also includes Franklin and Warren counties, which means let's just rip the Band-Aid off. This district is much more Republican than it was in 2020 when this was a nationally targeted congressional seat.
Well, I've had two tough cycles, two or three in a row, and this has always been a suburban-driven district. Any district, not to get wonky with folks, in Missouri at one point in time was 770,000 people in population. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that 536,000 of that is still St. Louis County, which is the heart and soul of the district. But I'm pleased that the district has moved out into areas like Franklin County, about two-thirds of Warren County, maybe 100, 120,000 in St. Charles. And what this is really giving me an opportunity to do is to expand my my agribusiness and my agriculture creds here. I have supported the Farm Bill for the almost 10 years that I've been in Congress, and I'm going to have some 1,800 family farms in Franklin County, over 500 in Warren County that I have the opportunity to represent. We'll be keeping an office open in Washington, Missouri, in Franklin County to serve constituents there. Constituent services are very important to me, so it is a little different. Now, I lost Jefferson County. Yeah. That makes me sad. You know, we moved and got a different portion of St. Charles, but I'm just honored to be able to continue to serve.
Okay, I don't want to go down a redistricting rabbit hole, but I mentioned the Richmond Heights part that goes around Webster Groves. Is it possible that after this election is over, somebody may file a compactness challenge and maybe you yeah. put Richmond Heights and Maplewood back into the first and the district becomes even more Republican?
Well, the first thing that listeners need to understand is that the congressional delegation has nothing to do, very little to do, I should say, and nothing any more to do with redistricting.
And they can influence, but they're not the decision makers.
No, it is the Missouri House and the Missouri Senate. And I have to say, I was disappointed in their progress and their process because we were the last map, the last state in the entire country to even have congressional districts. So people were in limbo for forever. You know, are these the lines that I perhaps would have drawn? No.
I saw Sarah Walsh who was running for Congress, and she didn't know where she was running. And neither did Trish Gumby, and neither did you.
It's the truth. And there were so many floating around out there, you just didn't know at the end of the day where it would end up. And that's the process every 10 years. And, a third of the district is brand new, and I'm excited about that.
Why do you think you would be a better member of Congress than your Democratic opponent, Trish Gumby?
Yeah, I'm running to, as I laid out in the last question, to stop this President Biden's radical socialist policies that have really drugged this country down into depths of an impending recession, have really assaulted our values and our very freedoms and way of life that are reckless and unsafe. And I believe that my opponent is running to be a rubber stamp for President Biden's and Nancy Pelosi's policies out there. I can tell you specifically that she has voted for Medicare for all, true socialism, universal health care that really at the end of the day we know means Medicare for none. It's the European style socialist Medicare for all. She's literally voted for higher taxes on every level, and whether it's the gas tax, property taxes, on down the line. She's advocated for a pathway to citizenship for illegal aliens. And as I said, another 4.5 million already, and that doesn't count the gotaways that may be over a million out there.
You mean, did she just do this on the stump? Because I don't think the Missouri legislature voted on immigration issues.
She put out a position paper specifically advocating for a pathway to citizenship for illegal aliens, and she has most specifically supported the defund the police efforts. I can tell you
now she says she doesn't support defund the
police. Well, let me tell you what. The record would say differently. She voted against Governor Parsons' signed police bill of rights measure that penalized cities that tried to defund the police. She voted against that. So, I mean, I'd say, as I said, her policies are nothing but a rubber stamp. And then I want to say this, to be honest. Being a legislator is about being a doer, not a show horse, a workhorse, someone who actually is able to deliver for the district. And that's what I am. I believe I'm an effective legislator, and I can say that my opponent has never, ever passed a bill through the Missouri legislature into law. Not one single bill in her time in the Missouri legislature. And I'm here alone, just this, in this Congress alone, Jason, the 117th Congress, I have passed 10 pieces of legislation through the House. Three of them are law already, and three more, once we get through this lame duck period, which is November through January, I believe will be passed into law also. And this is with a Democrat House and Senate and Democrat president.
Yeah, because she's going to say, like, it's a supermajority Republican legislature. She doesn't have a lot of ability to pass laws in that.
But what passing legislation is about is reaching across the aisle, being a doer, getting things done, finding solutions for your district. And these are the breadth and depth of these pieces of legislation, many of which are now law, are things like the Victims of Crime Act, the Southeast Strategy Act, increasing our trade and national security with our Indo-Pacific partners, the Israel Relations Normalization Act, which is between Israel and the Arab states, trade, national security, our own safety and security. I'm obviously on the Financial Services Committee, so there are several bills, two in particular, that deal with regulatory reform in the financial services sector. And I've got a great piece of legislation that I passed that deals with the financial exploitation of older investors. I'm able to be somebody that actually produces legislation, is an effective legislator, gets things done, and that's a direct contrast, I believe, to my Democrat opponent.
She says that she is making the fall of Roe versus Wade her top issue, and she is banking on a backlash in the 2nd District, especially since Missouri banned most abortions except for medical emergencies. What are you hearing on that issue?
Well, I've looked at the polling, both nationally and certainly in the state of Missouri and obviously in the 2nd Congressional District, and I can tell you the number one issue, the top set of issues that are on the minds of Missourians and those in the 2nd District have to do with inflation, the cost of living, jobs, the economy. If you combine those three together, that's somewhere between 55% to 60% of the district. And this is all. These are not just Republican numbers. This is independents, Democrats. They would then cite crime as a big issue, and a lot of that deals with the open border and fentanyl. That shows up as one of the top issues in their list of concerns. While abortion is certainly an issue that is of concern to some that'll be voting in the 2nd District, it is not top of mind and is pretty far down the issue set list at this point in time, because I think other things that are true kitchen table issues that are affecting their daily life have really overtaken that.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Your position on abortion is you are opposed to abortion except for instances of rape, incest, and life of the mother, correct?
Yeah, I have always been a pro-life advocate my entire life, Jason, and I will always stand up for life and for protecting the unborn. I believe that the biggest thing that the Dobbs decision did that, I fought for and marched for and prayed for 50 years was to send these decisions back to the states and their elected officials.
So you don't support Lindsey Graham doing a blanket 15-week abortion ban for everybody?
I support that these kinds of issues be returned to the states and their elected officials. And yes, when it comes to voting for federal policies, I have always stood with the three exceptions of life of the mother, rape, and incest. I can say at the federal level, there probably are some issues that dealing with abortion, like federal taxpayer dollars. We don't want that going towards abortions, maybe born alive legislation, gendercide. But the thing here really is that my opponent and the U.S. House of Representatives, which has voted twice on this issue, is extreme on this position. My opponent believes in an abortion on demand up and through 40 weeks. That is a full-term baby. I find their position reprehensible. I think most people in the 2nd District do. I think most people across the country and the world don't agree with that position.
And I want to get to other issues, but yes. When I asked her about that, because I knew that you were going to make that point, she says that she doesn't support that, but limit, because there could be instances after 20 or 26 weeks where the baby is going to die and they have to terminate the pregnancy after that.
As I said, she's made her position quite clear over and over again. She believes in free and full access to abortion up through full term 40 weeks. So I stand in stark contrast to that, and we'll see where the voters, you know, come down.
So if I think the Republicans are going to take over the House, and yes, your caucus is very eclectic. It includes people like you and Blaine Lucht-Demeyer and Sam Graves, who I think are like mainline Republicans but conservative on issues. And then more colorful people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz, who say all sorts of incendiary and crazy things. How is a Republican caucus going to be able to function properly, especially when there's still going to be a Democrat in the White House and the Senate may be 50-50 or fairly evenly split, even if it's a Republican majority?
Well, I think you're right. We are going to win back the U.S. House of Representatives, and that's going to be a mandate and really a statement not of the Republican Party in Congress, but one of the people. The people are fed up with these policies and the extreme decline in this country over the last, as I said, just 21 months. Elections have consequences, and they've seen those consequences, and they want change. I believe that I won't make any prognostications. I can say the numbers are turning, and the wind seems to be at our back in the House. Somewhere, I'm going to say between 20 and 30 seats we will pick up. I believe that now, given we've seen in terms of the movement of some of the undecided and independents as we get closer to Election Day, I think we're going to take the U.S. Senate also, which will put us in a stronger position legislatively. So to get to your point, I believe we can have a governing majority that is going to do things like, first of all, stop the out-of-control spending. We are not going to send, you know, as this past Congress and Nancy Pelosi has done and Chuck Schumer, send over $7 trillion of government spending, taxpayer dollars spent, down to the President of the United States to be signed.
Do you count that also, the COVID spending under President Trump, in that $7 trillion?
I do not.
Because some people would say that that also contributed to inflation,
well,
too.
I think that the CARES Act was something that we needed. It gave us helped our small businesses, helped for financial stability, helped with PPE, helped with our research, helped with the small businesses to keep those in place. So I supported the CARES Act. I didn't support, after President Biden took office, the additional $7 trillion. First, he spent $2 trillion on a Build Back Better agenda. He spent another trillion on a so-called infrastructure program that was all Green New Deal. He spent another $2 trillion just a couple months ago on this. He called it the Inflation Reduction Act, which is not even what Democrats refer to it as. So you can add it all up. It's trillions. And we're going to stop that. We're not going to send that kind of policy down to the president to sign. We're going to talk about regulatory reform. We're going to get behind energy independence. And here's the thing. I'm hoping that this will be such a strong signal to this White House that my hope certainly is that President Biden will work with us and do some of the kinds of shifts and moderations that you saw like a Bill Clinton do when he was president. Mm-hmm. Those are important things that are really on the, I think that's what the American people are hoping for to get us on the right direction.
Now, you mentioned inflation. There are other countries around the world that are dealing with inflation too. Isn't this something that is beyond a legislative body's control, and it is more of a global, I would say, byproduct of the pandemic ending or something like that?
Well, you know, there was all this talk at the beginning of this administration that this was a transitory situation. There was a time when perhaps leaving a pandemic one could have that discussion. But this president and Speaker Pelosi and Leader Schumer, both Democrats in the House and Senate, led us down a path that sunk us into this record high, 41-year high inflation. And it's because of the trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars that were not paid for of taxpayer government spending that exacerbated inflation. It's because of the overreaching arm of the administrative state or the regulators out there. There's an alphabet soup, as everyone knows, of whether it's the EPA, the SEC, the FDIC, the CFPB. I could give you one acronym after another that are right now passing rules and regulations to shut down business and to make it more difficult for them to prosper. And that cost, Jason, gets passed along to the American people. And the third thing I would say that has driven this inflation is a lack of unleashing energy independence. The first day this president came in, he shut down the Keystone Pipeline. There are 4,400 oil and gas leases right now out there that need to be signed and allowed to move forward that this president has stopped. You know, we don't have to be dependent upon OPEC and dictators and ayatollahs and others for our oil. We could have our own energy independence here and unleash it, especially in the area of liquid natural gas.
Well, that was going to be my next question. That Please. Has been a common thing that I've heard Republicans like say. They're mad about the Keystone Pipeline being shut down or our oil production not being at it is. But if the Keystone Pipeline had been not stopped, I think it would have been until 2023 or 2024 before it was completed. So would that have really affected the gas situation now? And same with like oil production, that's going to take a long time for that gas to go into the system or that oil to go into the system.
It doesn't take as long as you think. And we were a net exporter of LNG or liquid natural gas when President Trump left office and Joe Biden took over. As I said, he has stopped every single one of the drilling and fracking leases out there. The United States of America, I call us the Saudi Arabia of liquid natural gas. We should be exporting it. Not only would we have our own energy independence, we'd be exporting this to Europe and solving their energy crisis right now. And you know what else? It'd be 41% cleaner than what they're getting from Russia and from the East and from China and the other ayatollahs out there. I am an all of the above energy policy person. I mean, we should be pursuing all sorts of ways for clean energy. But I believe in things, clean energy, that would include things like nuclear. And certainly we've got to start the fracking and get these oil drilling leases that are offshore and onshore going again. He shut that all down. And to me, that has caused massive inflation and put us at risk vulnerably in terms of our national security. Because it's not a good place to be in. It's not a good place for the Europe to be in also. And they've seen that. They've tried to reverse their policies. And I just think there are so many implications, both that are inflationary, national security related, and trade and export related, that freeing up American energy would really solve. And that's what we're also going to be focusing on when we take back the majority.
We'll be right back after this quick break with Congresswoman Ann Wagner.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with Congresswoman Ann Wagner. She is running for re-election in Missouri's beautiful 2nd Congressional District. So I want to talk about Ukraine. And usually this would be a time when Sarah Kellogg would ask these questions, because as somebody who is half Ukrainian and whose family immigrated to the St. Louis area from Ukraine in the 1900s, I can't really say that I am unbiased on this issue, even though The Ukrainians did not treat Jewish people particularly well in the 1900s, but she is out sick. I feel like this is a really important issue, so I am going to ask these questions with that disclosure. Do you support the U.S. continuing to provide Ukraine with military and humanitarian aid?
I absolutely do. And I come at this as someone who is the number two ranking Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, in addition to financial services. But I do sit there with Michael McCaul, who will soon be the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee. I have traveled to the border of Ukraine, to Poland, to Moldova, to the entire region, gathering information, doing oversight, seeing what the situation is on the ground, the heartbreaking refugees that are trying to get out of the country and find a place temporarily to go. I have been uplifted, as so many Americans have and people across the world, by the strength and resiliency of the Ukrainians. They don't want us to fight their war. They just want us to provide them with the military and the weaponry and the military capacity to fight their own war. This is a free and sovereign nation. And this communist dictator, Putin, has come in, I believe, because he also saw American weakness, starting with our pullout in Afghanistan.
Is he really a communist, though?
He's
definitely an autocrat. I think he was a communist back when he was in the KGB.
He's a KGB agent, okay?
Once
a KGB agent, always a KGB agent.
Continue.
My son would say, once an Army Ranger, always an Army Ranger. But he is evil, and he has committed just a tyrant who has committed war crimes that he will be held accountable for. So I believe that it's our job to provide Ukraine with the weaponry to defeat Putin in Ukraine. He must be stopped there, because what I don't want to see is Article 5 triggered and to see Putin creep, because he won't end with Ukraine if he's not stopped, move into an Article 5 country. This is again a NATO country that we have an agreement with that would require American boots on the ground fighting that war. I don't want our sons and daughters boots on the ground. I don't want them fighting. I want the Ukrainians to defeat him with our support, that of NATO and the rest of the world in Ukraine. There has been talk recently, and I think you have another follow-on to that.
There has been reports about Kevin McCarthy, who will become Speaker of the House if Republicans take over, saying, we don't want to give Ukraine any more money. We have other issues that we have to deal with. Is that a mistake, given that Ukraine is about to retake Kherson and they have a lot of momentum right now?
Well, I've spoken with the leader, and I've spoken with our own leadership, and I think that his comments are being taken a bit out of context. What he really wants is, and I agree with wholeheartedly, is to see the proper oversight out there. He wants transparency. And I am quite worried about our own readiness capabilities here in the United States of America. So what has happened under the Democrat leadership is there have not been any hearings about the money that we've appropriated from a military or humanitarian standpoint to Ukraine. We don't know how much is left. We don't know what specifically has gone towards military. We don't know how much of it has gone to backfill our U.S. military readiness power. So I agree. This isn't going to be a blank check anymore. And that's what he said. Not a blank check. And it won't be. There's got to be oversight. There's got to be transparency. We have to worry about our own readiness. And you know what else? We have to make sure that our other partners in Europe, and they have come together, and in NATO. I mean, who would have ever thought that Sweden and Finland would ever join NATO?
I understand that is a controversy too. Like, there's been a lot of criticism of Germany that they haven't done enough because they are so dependent on Russian natural gas and energy. So if we were
supplying them from the U.S., they wouldn't be so dependent.
I get what you're saying on that. And actually, there's some bipartisan agreement that that's not enough. Now let's go to crime, because I think that is a major issue. What would a Republican Congress do to solve the crime problem, or at least make a dent in it? Since I would argue that this is a local issue, and I think that local jurisdictions need to have the most autonomy here about how they deal with it.
Well, That's true. I mean, one thing that we have to do first and foremost is to get off this rant of defunding the police. Our police have been absolutely defunded, demoralized, disrespected. They are quitting Congress. They're quitting the force in large numbers. We've seen it in every single state, in every single city across our country. I'm saddened by the statistic that the city of St. Louis is number one in crime across the entire U.S. And, you know, we've got to prosecute the criminals that are out there. We see prosecutors and DAs across the country and in our own city of St. Louis that agree with no cash bail, that agree that they are not prosecuting criminals. The backlogs are years long. They're, as I said, defunding and demoralizing our police officers. You know, we need to enforce, I believe, existing laws that are out there, and we've got to strengthen our law enforcement and stop the criminals from having free rein out there. It's because, you know what? Not only do people feel unsafe and are worried for their children's and their homes and their properties or whether they're leaving work in the city of St. Louis, they're also it's also a drain on our economy and jobs as people flee the area.
But you mentioned St. Louis and St. Louis County. They raised their sales taxes in 2007 for law enforcement, and I don't see a noticeable improvement. So isn't that kind of a pushback against the idea that more money for police is the only way to solve crime?
Well, they're not they haven't put that money towards the police department. Their force strength is way down.
Because they have a lot of vacancies.
They have left and they can't fill them. They can't find cops that want to work in the city of St. Louis. It is so sad. They have put restrictions on them in terms of the kind of weaponry they can use, how they protect themselves. Those police officers, because of the defunding and the disrespect and such, have moved out to the county, have moved to other states, have quit altogether. So I don't believe that the money that they may be raising, and certainly the money that they've gotten a huge influx, way too much from the federal government, sadly, through these, you know.
Through like the American Rescue Plan,
yes,
for example, because a lot of local governments
and county governments
have gotten that
too. They don't even know what to do with it. What they should be doing is not, you know, hiring more social workers and resource officers. They ought to be getting beat cops out there that can actually connect with the community, that can actually get out there and enforce the law, take the kind of the handcuffs off of them, and then you've got to have prosecutors that will prosecute the crime.
Well, that actually gets to my next question. I think that one of the problems is there's distrust between police and especially the African-American community. Is there anything that Congress can do to help foster a better relationship?
Yeah, you know, I think we can certainly, you know, recognize the situation. It's really a state and local issue more than anything. I don't know. I always hate it when the heavy hand of the federal government
right.
gets into issues that are local.
I would argue this isn't even really a policy thing. It's probably a more of a hearts and minds issue. And I think if you try to micromanage governmental policy to make people feel differently, I think you're going to fail,
especially when it comes to law enforcement issues or education issues. Those are issues that are decided closest to the people. But if you had more police officers that were out there interacting with the community, you know, walking the neighborhoods, in the schools, I think you'd have a much better relationship. But at this point in time, they don't have the kind of numbers and again, force readiness to even address real crime that's going down. And then when they actually make the arrests, nobody prosecutes them. They get out, no cash bail, and are on the streets again the next day. And this is also creeping out into the county. So this is an issue, the crime issue, that is an everybody issue. And the drugs are out of control. All I can tell your listeners is this fentanyl, it's one in dead. This is what I tell every child, every young person out there. I don't care whether it's a single stick of marijuana, one pill. I don't care if you're buying it over the internet and you think it's an Adderall or a Xanax. It's probably laced with, if it's not been given out by a doctor, a certified doctor and pharmacy, it's probably laced with fentanyl. 70,000 deaths in the last year. Again, this is a border issue, but it's a crime issue also.
Now, obviously, we're on the heels of this horrific tragedy in a St. Louis high school. And there's still a lot of unanswered questions about the situation. The facts are not 100% there. I understand that there may be a more localized or state response to this, but is there anything the federal government can do on providing more money for mental health? Because this was clearly like a mental health situation. I know that there's probably going to be a lot of Democrats who are going to be restrict guns after this. Is there any federal response that you could see to things like what happened on Monday?
Well, obviously, it's just we're all devastated by another, senseless shooting. It's just a tragedy. And we're certainly grateful for our law enforcement. I will say, even as deplenished and depleted as they are, the St. Louis City cops got there within 14 minutes and took down that shooter on the third floor of that school immediately. So we are grateful for their bravery and their swift action that saved lives. And it, as I said, breaks my heart. I live in this community. I raise my family here. I am a mother of three children, a mother of three grandchildren now, Jason. And as I said, it's heartbreaking. But I am the only person in this race that has actually supported and passed legislation that strengthened our background checks, like the Fix NICS program that we passed in 2018 that was signed into law that strengthened the NICS background check system by imposing kind of new reporting requirements and federal agencies, and that requires the DOJ to coordinate with state governments and things. So I've done some things that would really strengthen that background check. Second, we passed through the House the Stop School Violence Act, which helped us to harden our schools and provide metal detectors, deterrent measures, more security at schools and on school grounds. We also passed through the House in June of 2022, the Hope for Mental Health and Well-Being Act, which enhances behavioral health crisis centers and really sends money back to the states for mobile crisis care, emergency services, crisis call centers. I mean, so we've actually passed pieces of legislation that I think are good and sound. At the end of the day, especially if you're dealing with a mental health issue, it is incumbent upon all of us to be aware of our fellow man and those that are around us, our friends, our neighbors, the people we interact with. If they're struggling, we've got to get them the help. Hardened criminals will always find way to wreak havoc and hurt and destroy our society. But I don't think we need more gun laws. I want to be clear. I'm a big supporter of the Second Amendment. I think we have to enforce the laws that are on the books, prosecute those criminals, and strengthen law enforcement's hands so that they can both stop the criminals and the mentally ill. I'm sad to see this happen in this horrible tragedy happen in the city of St. Louis. We'll wait to see some of the other facts that unfold.
Thank you so much, Congresswoman, for coming in and talking with me today. By the way, we did record an episode with Trish Gumby during the primary, which we will put a link to. So if you are like me in the 2nd Congressional District, you can listen to both shows and make an informed decision. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. You can find all of our stories at stlpr.org. Follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. How can people follow you on Twitter or learn more about your campaign?
AnnWagner.com.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long.